Admiral Larkin, Reel 1. Could we start, please, by your telling me how you first came to be involved in the Falklands crisis, explaining what position you held at the time?
I was Captain Rachel Mascalis at the time. She was the one of the two amphibious assault ships, LPD, landing platform docks, involved. She was there from the beginning. She also was the headquarters ship for the Commodore Amphibious Warfare, who came to command the landings, and the Command 3 Commando Brigade, who was the commander of the land forces, and in accordance with the amphibious doctrine, took over the battle once we were established ashore. So I was, as the custom is in the Navy, the chief of staff to the Commodore Amphibious Warfare, Commodore Mike Clapp, while he was embarked in Fearless, and therefore a part of his staff, and a nominally chief of staff, as well as captain of the ship.
How did the news of the crisis first come to you?
With great suddenness. For actual dates, it would be best to cross-reference, of course, to the records, but Fearless had come back from a deployment in Norway, which is actually of some historical interest relating to the campaign, as it turned out. We were 1 week into a 3 week maintenance period, which is the stage, of course, when everything's been taken to bits and nothing's been put together again. It was Thursday of that week, and whereas one was dimly aware there was concern about the Falklands, it was very low key, and it was only that Thursday evening that we went home. Aware that things were very much not right, and was by nature of a crisis. The following morning, the Friday, I was phoned at 6 in the morning at home and told by my second in command, Commander John Kelly, that the ship had been placed on the first priority, short of Polaris, for stores, and the intention generally was that we should prepare for war. So I obviously aroused myself very rapidly and made my way into Portsmouth, where the ship was berthed, at Fountain Lake Jetty. I immediately convened a meeting of my heads of department. And meanwhile, news was coming in of what we were to be expected to do. It was the beginning of four, from Friday anyway to Tuesday at 10 o'clock, the following Tuesday when we sailed. We literally set about putting the ship together again and also determining what stores we had to embark, who we were to take, and what the general command structure would be. Just to pull out the most important factors, so far as storing went, we filled the ship with everything that we could lay our hands on so far as consumable vessels went. The ship was literally, the decks were literally packed with stores, whittling stores, including the inevitable Argentine bully beef, which caused everyone a certain amount of amusement. So far as military stores were concerned, we put together, in conjunction with our Royal Marine colleagues, a loading plan, which was derived from that which we used, which was ready for North Norway. As always, when an emergency occurs, you have no plans for the actual event, so you make the best of the plans you have. The plans are useful as a point of departure, although in detail you have to throw them out the window. So basically we loaded the ship as we indeed loaded the whole force that was being put together with the loading plan and designed for North Norway with modifications from what we could divine about the Falklands environment and terrain as best we could. We didn't. The loading plans, of course, were designed for mountainous terrain. The Falklands had mountainous aspects. Of course, one of our difficulties was we didn't immediately know very much about it. I was amongst those who had to go to the map and just work out what shape the Falklands were. For instance, we determined that it was about the size of Wales, and if we landed one end of the East Island, which turned out to be the case, we'd be about as far from our destination as, for instance, Llandudno in the north of Wales is from Cardiff in the south, between San Carlos has happened and Port Stanley. That gave us a feel for the scale of things. Very much, of course, like, for instance, the Shetlands. But all the problems. he was across the country, how he was doing it, what sort of vehicles we needed. All this had to be put together very rapidly. We embarked a polyglot collection of arms. There are records of this, but prominent amongst them was some light armoured vehicles. The ship was designed to carry heavy tanks, but we carried reconnaissance armour, that scimitar and scorpion, which were collected from the Blues and Royals, who happened to be on duty for that weekend at Windsor. A very colourful lot they turned out to be. A certain amount of artillery. This was from 29 Regiment Royal Artillery, who are of course attached to the Royal Marines, a part of the Royal Marines, and ammunition. Aircraft, the ship has a landing deck, a helicopter deck. We stacked on four Sea Kings, which was more than we'd ever done before, packed close up against the superstructure, which was left one operating spot for the after end. And the flight deck itself was ingeniously loaded with shake-ons and all sorts of things, just leaving enough room to manoeuvre the aircraft around and to operate them. As far as people were concerned, it's my recollection that we had something like 1,400 people on board the ship for every day of the campaign. Obviously they were static to begin with, but once we got to Ascension Island and later down to the Falklands, they changed on a daily basis. The normal complement of the ship's company was, again, records will provide the detail, but about 660, as I recall, of whom 90 were Royal Marines belonging to the Assault Squadron, which operate the landing craft, and the rest aboard the sailors of various types you need for that kind of ship. And we embarked, of course, the aviators from the helicopters and the support operations embarked, and all kinds of other people, including, of course, the staff of the Commandant of Warfare and the Commander 3 Commando Brigade, the then Brigadier Julian Thompson. So, staff officers, again, I'm guessing, would say 150, and every bit of space was utilised as never before. So far as getting ourselves ready from thinking it all through was concerned, obviously the Commodore and the Brigadier were only joined by helicopter after we'd left when we were off the South Coast. As to myself, I was in contact with the third flotilla to whom we belonged, Admiral Repple. Admiral Derek Repple, then I think a Vice Admiral, of course very much hoped that he would be in command of the operation, and there was a certain reason to suppose that he might be as the commander of the large ships and the amphibious vessels, although in fact it turned on Rear Admiral Woodward, who was already down in the May training and ready to put together an embryo task force or an embryo battle group and start making his way south. But we spent a lot of time up in the headquarters, and later I recall a conference on board HMS Invincible where with then Captain Jeremy Black we looked into some of the tactical problems we might encounter, and we engaged of course the services of the Maritime Tactical School, who are based at HMS Dry at Fort Southwark, and I recall Admiral Black's remark, Exocet versus Exocet, that's not nice, is it? Referring, of course, to principal weaponry as a system which both sides possess. So far as the third flotilla was concerned, it must have been the Friday, or was it Saturday morning, but I recall being up in the headquarters with Admiral Ruffle and his staff when the parliamentary debate was in progress concerning the Falklands, and I was particularly impressed by Michael Foote's impassioned speech supporting direct action, which of course very much involved the opposition from the start in the government's general combat of affairs, but it was, as it went, Michael Foote, a very splendid speech. I have to say, the rest of that period passes in something of a continuum of meetings and all sorts of action, very capable people getting things ready, but I was constantly involved in one way or another. We managed to sail at 10 o'clock the following Tuesday morning. The day after Hermes, I recall, and Invincible also managed to get away rather earlier. And, of course, the passage down Portsmouth Harbour was one of those events which one does not readily forget. Tremendous enthusiasm from the dockyard. We were slightly into the Thatcherite age, and perhaps things were better than the dockyard. I recall some 10 years before, when I'd been trying to refit HMS Glamorgan during a coal miners' strike in a 3-day week. But the efforts put in by the dockyard were prodigious. The support and enthusiasm was, of course, very impressive. There was a touch of jingoism about it, which has never come particularly happily to me. We weren't a very jingoistic ship, and we never looked at the events in that way, although we were always very encouraged when people showed the sort of enthusiasm we experienced while leaving the harbour. But there was the downside of this too. When you're an amphibious ship, you go to sea, an amphibious ship with a docking capability, you have to embark your landing craft when you're clear of the harbour. And as we were used to, we went down the harbour to Spithead, where all the fuss was over. We anchored in our normal, one of our normal berths in the Spithead anchorage. We set about embarking our landing craft, and quite probably some of the aircraft. We carried some light aircraft, Gazelles, as well as the four big Sea Kings. And there we had a rather unpleasant interlude, because the local radio and television stations were playing over interviews with families who had seen us go, and that was not a particularly encouraging experience for people who obviously are very resolute, who were extremely apprehensive as to what was in store for us. No, it was not a particularly comfortable period. But later that day, we'd completed all our preparations. We set off down channel, collecting around us mainly a small convoy, which was mainly comprised the landing ship logistic, the Knights of the Round Table class. I think it was all but Sir Bedivere. That must mean Sir Lancelot, Sir Geraint, Sir Galahad, and Sir Tristram, who had been loading the march with military force in Southampton Water. We all were very heavily laden, indeed some to a degree that caused some concern. It was Sir Lancelot slightly smaller than the others, and we spent some time ensuring that we understood from the captains of these ships and Royal Fleet Auxiliary what their loading situation was and what problems they felt they might have in a major seaway and that sort of thing. Again, records will show precisely what ships we had in company, but it was mainly a grave ship event. I don't think at that stage we had any ships taken up from trade. They were still in the main being converted, and as is well known, ships came on, were fed forward with their various loads as they became ready with immediate conversions for flight decks and for extemporized helicopter decks and that sort of thing. And we then made our way towards Ascension Island, which we reached, as I recall, and again my dates may not be quite right, but with I think it must be in the 5th or 6th of April that we sailed. We were in the vicinity of Ascension Island some 2 weeks later, rather less than 2 weeks later, on the, I think, probably the next hallmark or landmark date must be the 17th. What did we do while we went down there? Well, obviously, we adjusted ourselves to what was to us a really extraordinary situation, where we were expecting that we would be used in anger. I think, like everybody else, we recognised that in the main, or in the first instance, the sailing the task force had been a political event. It was an indication of resolve. We're very enthusiastic about that, because it was what our business was all about. It's what we trained for, what the whole amphibious force had been designed to do. And as there was at that time something of a cloud over the future of Phyllis, our sister ship Intrepid, who incidentally was being brought forward from upkeep by operation or whatever the current euphemism was for a certain level of reserve. She'd only just been decommissioned, fortunately, so it was possible to recall, I think, about 90% of her ship's company from the original ship's company. But she was being activated, that was some 2 weeks away there, before she'd be ready. But this is exactly what it was all about for us. So we were delighted to be used, we were delighted to be being used as the forefront of a political activity, a high-level diplomatic activity. I don't think we thought very much about the Falklands as a great cause, but then one doesn't, I don't think. I think we felt that what had happened was very wrong, and this was clearly the recovery of the Falklands by one means or another seemed to be a very just and proper estimate paid. I think we shared the outrage expressed by Michael Foot, which sort of comes to the forefront of the British at times like these, even if it's not probably that it was all rather unnecessary, that had things been managed better at a high level, at a high political level, for reasons which have been very well rehearsed, very well gone into by Simon Jenkins, for instance, in his book which he wrote with Max Hastings quite shortly after the conflict, The Battle of the Hawkins, very well gone into and well known. So we have no doubt what we're about. Apprehension, of course, and I think everyone was very clear that you don't often load up in earnest without there being something very important and vital afoot. Very much shaking down with each other. I think, although we exercise regularly with the Royal Marines, I think the sense of intimacy that ought always to exist between the Navy and the Royal Marines was not as in such good order as it should have been. And it's been very much my pleasure later to spend the next and final 10 years of my career in helping with the Royal Marines very much put that to rights. It wasn't that we didn't get on with each other, we just didn't know each other well enough. And they didn't understand, they being the Royal Marines, didn't really understand maritime problems as well as they ought. And although we were paid to understand their problems and we did our best, I don't think we understood their problems well enough either. And the two staffs, the staffs of the Colonel Amphibious Warfare and the Brigade, spent a lot of that time really getting to know each other and to iron out a get through a fairly superficial level, if I could put it that way, of common cause, and an acquaintanceship rather than friendship, into real common cause, mutual understanding and operational nature. I'd like to think that I was quite helpful in achieving this. I always regret that I wasn't more forceful in the prerogative which really I ought to have had as the owner of the ship, to always dine with the Commodore and the Brigadier, but for some reason they didn't seem to want me to initially and I didn't press it. I think I was quite a good catalyst in adjusting the different points of view, and I feel that for me that is an opportunity missed. I have since got to know them very well, and they're both friends, and I think that that would have been acceptable to them too. But I think I did perform quite a useful role in helping everyone work along together, as befits the chief of staff. I think I was quite good at that. If I wasn't perhaps outstanding good at other things, that was a contribution. Lots of exercising went on. People were concerned to be physically fit. People concerned to live harmoniously in this heavily overcrowded ship. Well, that, I think, went very well. There were demarcation, there were turf demarcation disputes, of course, but they were readily ironed out, I think. We were trying to get grips with the plans and the direction coming from headquarters at Northwood, and the whole command structure was at that stage in a state of flux. The command structure and indeed the objectives of the operation were two things that continued to be a matter of concern. And I don't think I'll go into them in great depth in this because they really require rather careful historical analysis, which one day I'd love to contribute, but I don't think it would be very useful to try and analyse them too deeply here, although I'll mention them as we go along. We recognised, understood that Admiral Fieldhouse at Northwood was the four-star commander of the operation. The position of Admiral Woodward as the senior officer afloat, it was assumed he would generally be in charge, but the general, or rather I should say the command structure, took some time to really establish themselves, and I don't think they were ever really sorted out entirely satisfactorily. And there were misunderstandings which were perpetuated through the period, which I have to say have not been ironed out to this day, and again, to unravel those would be something that I would be delighted to contribute to in due course. They need to be studied carefully with all the sources. We arrived in the vicinity of Ascension Island, I think it was the 17th of April, again the record will show, and that was an important day because Admiral Woodward, who had arrived there a few days previously in Hermes, as soon as we were close enough to be reached by helicopter from Hermes, flew across for a conference. This was a very important conference, which has been written about by a lot of people. It years ago. I'd served him several times. I guided him. He was certainly something of a mentor of mine. And he also is someone I'm privileged to include as a personal friend now. I felt, I knew that it was going to be very difficult building a relationship between Brigadier Thompson, Commodore Clapp, and Admiral Woodward. Commodore Clapp knew him a bit, but Brigadier Thompson not at all. And I knew this meeting was going to be crucial. And I did do my utmost to try and prepare the ground for the way I knew that Admiral Woodward would play it, which I knew would be provocative. He fires out ideas to get responses. He likes debate, he likes to stimulate debate, so he'll quite deliberately put out ideas, some of which are not obviously not very near the mark, but nevertheless they help define the confines of what we're about. So I did my best to brief my two bosses in Fearless as to what to expect and indicate how they might usefully or how they might best play the event. Again, one must tread carefully in these circumstances. It was a sadness to me that it was all to no avail. It was not a very successful meeting. Admiral Woodward asserts this day that it was a successful meeting, but he threw out his ideas, which didn't unfortunately give rise to the sort of lively debate that I knew he was expecting. A variety of the ideas exposed are quite against doing that, served to offend particularly Brigadier Thompson, because he considered them to be ill-considered and outlandish, and that, I'm afraid, set a pattern which was to continue to create difficulties throughout the campaign. Now, much had been made of these differences, and various people have written books about it. I think Admiral Woodward's, dare I say it, is a very fair one, because he is true to himself. He knows himself, and he says that, so far as he was concerned, it was fine. I didn't bring that the Commodore thought it was fine. Commodore Clapp not written about it, and Brigadier Thompson has written quite extensively about the campaign, and I'm afraid to say that he has tended to, as he's continued to update his views. I'm afraid he's played on the extent of misunderstandings as opposed to, dare I say, attempting to seek the reason for them, and perhaps to allow some of the other factors to enter the considerations. Anyway, it needs to be analysed carefully. I think it was very sad. But on the bright side, this kind of event involves enormous communication problems. It's problems about people and people communicating by imperfect means. If we remember the silence of Gallipoli and certain amphibious undertakings that we've engaged upon, they're all extremely complicated from a command and control point of view. It's a feature of amphibious warfare. And this whole campaign, yes, there were misunderstandings and difficulties, but they were overcome. We did manage to do, in a macro sense, all the right things in all the right ways. And things did go wrong, but they were not the thing that affected the course of the campaign. Things will always go wrong, but the major things went right. And I think it's a great tribute to all concerned, and I speak most warmly of all the principals, and I only lamented their misunderstandings between each other in my own failure to be more effective in sorting them out, or helping them sort them out. And the fact of the matter is that they all managed to get on together well enough to make the thing work. And against the precedent of this sort of thing, I think that's a tremendous achievement. So that's probably enough of that. It was a very important meeting, and it was sad, in my view, that it wasn't a more harmonious one. It led up to a meeting the following day at Ascension Island, which we've now, where we've now arrived in Fearless with our little polyglot collection of logistic ships, for a major meeting on board Hermes, for which Admiral Fieldhouse flew out from the UK. And that was an important meeting, and it did involve a certain amount of resolving of differences and it's interpreted by some as Admiral Woodward's more outlandish ideas being put on one side, but Admiral Woodward wouldn't see it that way at all. He would have decided that his ideas were to stimulate, not to reach conclusions. And a number of conclusions were reached. Most importantly, a certain amount of debate was entered into about what the aims of the operation were. I was on the fringes of that meeting. I was on board Hermes, the chief of staff. Again, I rather hoped to be nearer the middle of it because I thought I had a constructive role to play. But it was nice to be around that day and interesting to get a perspective from people who had flown out to the UK as to what was going on. And Admiral Fieldhouse flew back by VC-10 from Wide Awake Airfield in the Central Island that night. Immediately after that meeting, Admiral Woodward set off south with his battle group. And I remember watching them sail from Ascension early one morning, all looking very splendid. There was a submarine scare going on at the moment, at the time. And we did used to have submarine scares in the weeks that followed. We allowed our excess, our minds to wander, or to not wander, but we thought quite systematically about the sort of things that the Argentines might do if they knew that a group of ships who were going to be inconvenient to them, or the force was assembled at Ascension. And as always, on these occasions, you tend to attribute them with your own background, your own imagination, your own capabilities. And so, obviously, sort of the sort of things that we would do if we were the Argentines and we were in that position. So, we thought quite a lot about submarines, underwater swimmers. We knew that the Italians and the Argentines had something in common, and the Italians always had shown great prowess at individual feats of gallantry. As indeed to the Argentines in due course. So we thought there might be some underwater activity. But the Russians were clearly taking interest. There was an AGI, or surveillance vessel, off Ascension most of the time that we were there. We had no doubt that we were being listened to fairly systematically. How long were we there? Dates of the campaign will tell, but we spent very nearly 2 weeks of Ascension following the 17th of April. Therefore, we must have sailed around about the 3rd or 4th of May, that sort of thing. We were very much into the next stage of our preparations. There were definite things to be done so far as the amphibious force was concerned. We had left England in a state of what is called our loading plans were by no means as well organised as we would wish. I've mentioned the Norwegian campaign background. Well, we'd obviously put a lot of thought into how we'd actually wish to deploy our military force when we got to the Falklands, and that involved what's called a lot of cross-loading, which basically means reorganising the way that all the ships are loaded so things can basically be extracted when you get to the battle area in the right sort of order, which is quite a jigsaw puzzle. And when you think of lots of ships, basically like railroads, think of cars crowded into a railroad, or maybe lorries crowded into a railroad, and you need those lorries out in a particular order, and where they are on board the ship does matter quite a lot. So there's an awful lot of rearranging to be done. It was done with landing craft and helicopters. We were very nervous about the endurance of our helicopters. They were a limited asset in terms of their sustainability.